very briefly, the clergy and the laity. The idea of a special priesthood comes from the Old Testament. And the early church imported it. It had two sources. Actually, it came from heathenism. You see, all the heathen religions of that day had a kind of priesthood, a degenerating view of the priesthood derived from the Old Testament. All religions originally emanate from historic Orthodox Old Testament theology. And thus, the heathens always had a hierarchy of priests within their religion. And when these heathens, unbelievers from the Greek or other groups, came in, they brought a lot of their ideas with them. And when the Jews came in to the church, they brought the idea of the Old Testament priesthood. So it was not to be wondered at that the idea of a priesthood survived. Now you may remember the Levitical priesthood had three orders within it: the high priest, the priest, and the Levite. Now may I humbly suggest that when you find the three orders of ordination in the Roman Church, the bishop, the priest, and the deacon, you have the Christian answer, or the Christian trilogy, resembling the Old Testament priesthood. Now, this was developed in the second century. Now, this is directly contrary to the biblical teaching of the New Testament, namely, the priesthood of the believer. You see, the apostolic and the post-apostolic church of the second century had a great deal of trouble in integrating the plain biblical teachings with the traditions which these groups had inherited when they were born in the church, namely the heathen and the Jews, which leads to a point I want you to consider. And it may be heresy to bring it up. If so, make the most of it. that a non-biblical or sub-biblical approaches in evangelism do great harm to the church by allowing non-biblical influences, elements of the non-believing world to gain a foothold in the church. Now, the early church is an excellent illustration of this truth. Now, I can explain why it happened, particularly after 400, when the barbarians were really gaining a foothold in the empire. The Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Lombards, the Vandals, the Anglo-Saxons, the Franks, and whatnot, the Burgundians, they came in hordes, and they were knocking, say, at the door of the church, and the church sent out missionaries. And don't misunderstand me. I'm not for a moment saying we shouldn't evangelize them. Not for one moment. But the church faced a tremendous problem. Most of these people, particularly the Burgundians, and the Lombards, and the Goths, were not able to read or write. There are a few of them that did, but I mean the great majority didn't. How do you evangelize groups that can neither read nor write? Visual education. Pictures. Images. Statues. Now, I don't defend that. But you see, the church was faced with a problem and they engaged in what today we call mass evangelism. And they engaged in it for different reasons, because they were faced with a problem that we, for the most part, don't have. I mean, sheer, absolute, undisguised illiteracy. And so, they substituted images and pictures and all the trappings for a full gospel. in the Great Commission. Remember what the Great Commission says? Go into all the world, teaching and preaching all things whatsoever I have commanded you. Now the Greek is more emphatic, all the things I have commanded you. And the early church failed in this. And these educated pagans, these uneducated heathens from the world around, and the educated Jewish people, brought into the church trappings of their old systems. And it greatly aided the development of the later Roman Catholic system of the clergy. It was developing even in the second century. Do you see that? No. The early art, yes. I would never deny.
Because I sort of look at that as very.
Well, let me put it to you this way, since you've raised a very good question. And it is a good question. So let me put it to you this way, that I believe, if I might be dogmatic, that mankind, or some men at least, have the gift of art, and they feel the need for expressing it. And in a Christian age like the Middle Ages or later, they did it by expressing their talent in terms of the biblical message. I don't think to say that Rembrandt was trying to educate the people through visual means. And yanking him out, or hold back.
What about El Greco?
Yeah, El Greco.
El Greco has so many religions.
Yeah, all right, that's more modern.
That's true.
That's not true. Yeah. Angelo is actually telling the story. Yeah. That was
later.
But
who's that
real early one?
I
don't know.
I think
there's
a difference between Gilberti. Gilberti, yeah. Well, he was early Renaissance. He's one of the early Italian Renaissance painters. There's a slight difference. Now, I would agree, but look, wait before. How many of you have had Sunday school literature which you have had Hoffman's Portrait of Christ? Please tell me what the difference is. Yeah. There's a difference in type of painting. But is there a basic fundamental difference between having a statue of the church and having a picture of Christ in Sunday school literature?
I think we still got some religious and doctrinal content even in Sunday school.
Well, I just say we don't.
I guess the question was, how much did they carry out the Great Commission? How much doctrinal content?
You mean in the early church?
In their teachings. To the
no. In the very early church, they had the catechetical instruction, and that was stiff and rugged. But that began to die out. As the you see, when vast numbers of Christians start to come to church, it's hard to do that, particularly if you're lacking instructors. Let me give an example of what I mean. In 496 AD, Clovis, the Frankish king, faced a great battle with the Alemannic. Now, he was a pagan, but his queen, Clotilda, was a Christian, a fine lady. And the night before the battle, he told Clotilda that if she would pray to God to give him the victory, that he would become a Christian, he and his army. Well, he defeated the Alemanni, and he kept his word. He issued general order day number one, and the whole army got and said, they're going to be baptized, period. And they baptized the whole army. Now, that was a kind of superficial entrance in the church. I mean, you know, when the general in chief says you do it, what do? You do it, don't you?
Yeah. anything left in there.
And if you're real smart, you'll get baptized. Whether you know what you're doing or not, but you'll certainly go through the act, because that general's going to get you if you don't. Now, that's the extreme example. But it also affects what was happening. Now, let's go on.
Well, you said that was the end of it. They didn't try to bring in. They used to instruct the people in at that point.
No.
As baptized, said, you're Christians, and I go back.
They did have churches, but by that time, you're still faced with an army that couldn't read or write. How do you instruct them? It's no wonder, as I was trying to find out before the break, that the Benedictine order had schools attached to the monasteries, because the monastic schools, in terms of the education available, were good, and they did a yeoman's job in teaching. But you see, up in Gaul, where he was a king, where Clovis was king, they didn't have many monasteries. Certainly not enough monks to teach that vast horde. And there was a great deal of illiteracy. I'm not denying that. And the
problem itself was so disorganized, it was incapable of responding.
It could not do. It could respond in the sense that Clovis would keep an answer to keep his promise to Clotilde, yes. And you sent another later Saint Augustine went to Great Britain to evangelize him, and yet there are also some interesting facts. there was a great revival in Ireland, the Great Irish Revival in the 5th century, and a little later there was a great scholar in Ireland by the name of Theodore of Tarsus, who was a great Greek scholar. Now how a man from Tarsus got to Ireland, no historian has ever been able to explain. Nobody knows why or how. Now, there were things like that. There were centers of education, but to conduct an effective evangelistic campaign, they simply didn't have the resources. And so they resorted to visual aids. Now, I can explain it. And I guess in a sense, I can, on a degree, justify it. But that doesn't justify our simplistic, superficial evangelism of the day. You see what I mean? Now.
But on this role of art, I'm still.
Are you an artist?
No. But when you think of, like you were saying, of great painters like Rembrandt
and Giotto. I yanked him out of blue. I was, you know.
But. We don't really know that they were painting to evangelize.
No, I just said, I was denying it.
Right.
I mean, in the case of Rembrandt, he left notes. Now, in the case of Michelangelo, they were patronized by the papacy. You're thinking of his painting of the Vatican, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see. Today, a man is commissioned to paint the portrait, of Mr. Reagan or any great notable figure. It's part of his professional job. Now, I think Michelangelo was probably a Christian.
Well, he had a lot of struggles through his whole history with the painting.
Yes, he did.
I mean, it wasn't just that they went out and paid him because he went, through.
It was a life work for him. It was a life work for him. Now, Holbach and Holbein in their pictures and chronic Luther and the other reformers, they did it as a labor of love to preserve to posterity what these men looked like. Although I think they were paid for it, they had lived after all. But see, these men were not engaged in mass evangelism. I'm speaking this early deal by which mass evangelism was carried on. Now,
but it really wasn't the evangelist's fault that the converted believers worshipped the pictures instead of the idea.
Or the statues, or
well,
are the other thing too. What's connected with that is discretion or the integrity of saying, well, you know, this is what it is. And you
well, that was necessary as a part of that whole picture. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to upset you with this, Kathy. I was trying to do a distinction.
Oh, no, I'm not upset. I'm just trying to see the whole picture.
I'm trying to give it to you. And I guess
I'll be
I'm not.
Quiet.
No, Kathy, I didn't mean it that way. I didn't mean it that way at all. My words failed me, is what I'm trying to say.
See, we have this picture like somebody running around with a picture of Christ, and this is Christ who saved you, and trying to evangelize these people.
No.
That's the picture.
No, they did do it as a means of educating people rather than evangelizing. It was more of a matter of I'm inducting them into faith. And I think I had some very serious problems.
I think the problem isn't strictly... Let me try again. You ended up, if you had, when you brought a whole household into the church by eating, or you brought a whole army into the church by command.
Yeah.
You end up with a lot of people who are really not Christians who are suddenly, supposedly, within the body. And you see the problem of how do you educate those people who can't even read anything you've given them?
That's right.
And so instead of educating, they did away with educating. Since they couldn't do it, they said, instead, we will give them something they can associate with.
That's not 100% true, because they did try to educate to the extent they had ability to do it in the monastic schools and with great teachers having clusters around them. But that was not... the monastic schools couldn't possibly... The schools in Italy, for instance, as good as they might be, or in southern France, where the Benedictines had considerable influence, they could not possibly... handled the situation in Germany. Now, gradually, the German monasteries developed. They did develop schools, but you see, I probably shouldn't bring this to turn this off. All events are under the control of the sovereign God. Nothing happened. Let me ask you this. I don't know your history, and I'm not asking you to give it. Or Kathy's, Tom's, or Fernandez. But looking back, as you interpret the events of your life, and you say, oh, how would I ever survive that? Why did this happen to me? Or I had a bad accident, or I barely avoided an accident, any number of things. Looking back, you can see how the hand of a sovereign God was working in your life. There are no actions with God.
Yeah, but I don't believe everything that's happened to me in my life was His will.
Well, then whose was it?
I guess I have to believe that there's a force of evil at work there, too.
Let me ask you this question, Bill. Are those forces of evil beyond the control of a sovereign God?
No, they're not beyond His
control. Well, are they not? Will you stick with that statement?
I'm not sure. I may not.
But you see, you said
He allows a certain...
Oh, he does what?
I think he allows some freedom.
Did I say he did?
No, they're controlled by him, but they may not be controlled by him in every circumstance.
What about the book of Job?
He gave Satan a lot of flexibility.
Oh, but what? Thou shalt not do what?
They put restraints and limits.
Thou shalt not harm my servant Job. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
All right. That God allowed that to happen. But what did he do? He turned every one of those to what? His own glory.
I agree with that. And that's why I'm having a little trouble with what you're saying. Because I agree. I said that God will turn it to good. And God's purpose will be accomplished in the
All right.
world, just like my purpose in building a cabinet might be.
I didn't say it won't.
Even though errors are made along the way.
Errors are made. But those errors are not accidental. I didn't bring my confession of faith with me. But God controls all events, yet He's not the author of evil. He permits, but in permitting, He controls. Nothing can come to you as a Christian but which He permits it and uses it for His glory. There's no accident that ever happens to you. No accident that happens to me. I may call them an accident. Now, one time when I was in grad school, I was driving along the main thoroughfare up to Philadelphia. And a terrible thunderstorm came up, and I had all my windows closed. I was overcome by monoxide gas. And I plowed in the car ahead of me, and I didn't know what had happened. And I fell from the service station, saw the accident happen, and came tearing out in the rain, and opened up the window, and revived me, and took me to a hospital. Now, if I hadn't had that accident, quote unquote, see, which was an act of will on my part, because I'm trying to keep the myself from the water coming in, I grant I did not know that the exhaust pipe was leaking carbon monoxide, but I was out. I didn't know I did anything. Now, the Lord used that accident, quote unquote, to save me from carbon monoxide poisoning, which I doubtly would have had. Now, looking back at the time, I didn't see it. All I know, I was full of bumps and bruises and sores all over. I didn't have any broken bones, but I sure hurt. I was stiff and a few other things. And the car was not in so real shape. And I can look back on my life and see these things. No. Read Augustine's Sea of God, and no accident.
But it's confession of faith.
Yeah, it's confession of faith, which is a little shorter.
Yeah.
There's no accident history. The church is never an accident. If it is, then your redemption is an accident. And if it's an accident, then it's beyond control, beyond regulation, and has no meaning. Accidents have no meaning. Verstehen Sie, mein Freund? Ja?
Ja, ich verstehe.
Ja, das ist gut. That's Spanish.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
What a dialogue.
Right.
That's how we make it. New Spanish dialogue. New Spanish. Sounds good as your
Korean. Yeah. No, I didn't mean enough on that.
I think what you were saying there is a lot of things that we do as Christians get wrong. We still want to control our lives.
Sure we do.
So many times a Christian will say, you know, well, I've turned my life over to the Lord.
Yeah. But
and that makes me a Christian. But if the Lord's not doing what I want him to do in my life, I'm going to take it back.
That's right. I can do it better. Yeah, we do.
That's humanity.
Yeah, we all, that's the human in us.
Yeah.
Now, in the third century AD, the terms clergy and laity began to be used. The terms clergy and laity began to be used to discuss or to describe the growing distinction. And the clergy began to assume the role of a necessary medium between the people and God, or mediator between people, the people and God. But they still did not regard the ministry as a sacerdotal office. But once you begin to regard the ministry as a kind of special medium or mediator between God and man, the sacerdotal concept will grow out. The word priest came into use during the 3rd century. Let me summarize my position. In the 3rd century, the main outlines of a future complete hierarchy become apparent. After the 3rd century, the clergy could not engage in business. After, say, 351. Now, celibacy was still optional. Tertullian was married, Gregory Nyssa was married, and other members of the clergy were married. Contrary to the Roman Catholic claim, celibacy was not even imposed by the Roman papacy at that time, and certainly X number of the clergy were married clergy. We don't have any Gallup poll breakdown, but it's there was no clerical costume until the 4th century. Laymen could still teach the Bible. Origen, in the 3rd century, taught the Bible in the East, in the Eastern Church. The Council of Carthage in 398 laid down the dictum that the layman cannot teach in the presence of the clergy, without the consent of the clergy. In other words, if an elder was to teach, he could only do it with the consent of the clergy. That's Councillor Carthy. But in the church down to after 300, Justin Martyr, Clement of Alexandria, Origen, Tertullian, Arnobius, Lactantius in the West, they were either just laymen or were presbyters, that is, elders, and were not in the clerical order of the priesthood. So that the distinction grew slowly, and the great laymen could still teach. Now, let's get down to my last topic today, and then we'll let you go. Are you tired yet? Am I making this clear to you? Am I challenging you? You must remember, I'm a strict Calvinist, I'm a covenant theologian, and I will never conceal my position. I'm not trying to argue you into it, but I want you to understand my whole position so that you'll get the message. Now, let's look at the origin of the episcopacy or the bishopric. There are several arguments advanced by the Roman Church and others for the concept of a bishop. I might add the Episcopal Church in this country and the Anglican Church in England and the Greek Orthodox Church use the argument I'm going to give you. Now, I'm just saying it's there. They use the position of James of the Church of Jerusalem. But in so doing, they demolish the Roman Catholic concept of the supremacy of Peter. Now, so far as the exegesis is concerned, so far as the history is concerned, these people are correct. James did preside at the Council of Jerusalem. If you read the controversy between the Judaizers and Paul in Acts 15, you'll see that this is the case, that James did preside over the 16. He did preside over the church, no argument about it. And then he gave them the right hand of fellowship. And they looked up to James. there's also the testimony of Ignatius of Antioch, whom I think last year, week or two, I mentioned as a disciple of John. Now, in his writings, I've read them, Ignatius does say that the bishop existed. The problem is not what he said, but what did he mean by what he said. He's speaking of the episcopos, or the episcopos, as a bishop or as a presbyter overlooking the older people, older man in office overlooking and taking spiritual oversight of the people. We don't know. Now, the Clement of Alexandria and said that John, after he, this is also a tradition, but Clement of Alexandria, writing, said that John returned from Patmos and ordained Polycarp as Bishop of Smyrna. Polycarp didn't say it, but Alexander did. I'm giving those arguments for what they're worth. But now, what are the arguments for the position that the episcopate or the bishopric emerged at the New Testament church? There's one very, very clear argument which points this truth. Namely, the New Testament identifies the presbyters and the bishops. I think I put that on the board for you, did I not once? That the word presbyter denotes the quality of man that holds the office, whereas the word episkopos in Greek denotes the role or the function of the presbyter who holds that office. Namely, the elders must have the spiritual oversight of the church. And in Titus and Timothy, you have the description they have, as well as in Peter. What should the bishop be like? in addition to this argument, there's another argument. Namely, the two terms are still used in the 2nd century, 200-300 AD, to describe the same office, the same role. Now, this is incontrovertible. And then the famous statement by Jerome that the church was ruled by Calvin Council presbyters. Now, a question? Am I upsetting your training in this?
It's definitely a different light on it than what I, I was trained in.
But you said something that I would like a little expansion on. You said the New Testament identifies the qualities and the function.
You weren't here when I did that, I don't think. One thing I hate is chalk. There is. Oh, yeah. Presbyteros. That's our word presbyter comes from presbyter, right? That's the Greek. P, rho, epsilon, sigma, beta, epsilon, tau, epsilon, rho, omega, sigma. The word presbyterian comes from there. It's the comparative degree of the adjective for old. Old, elder, eldest. Now, that denotes the type of man to hold the office. The elder among you, writes Peter and Paul. Now, epsilon P, sigma, kappa, omicron, P, epsilon, omega. This means to look over, to oversee, to have sight upon in the sense of taking care of. Now, we get the word bishop from that. I'll show you how. On the law of linguistics, they had simply dropped the epi. It became skup. Now, but they dropped the epsilon, but they kept the P, and the P then hardens to a B under Grimm's law. They kept the E other, but you say biscop, they drop the ending to the verb, and it becomes or the noun, omicron sigma, and you drop them, and you try and say biscop. Under the law of grammatics, the kappa became an S, an H, and so you have the word bishop emerging linguistically out of this. You see that? Now those words are used interchangeably. When Peter and Paul write in the New Testament are speaking of the type of man to be in the office, they use the word ho presbyteros, or hoi presbyteros, the plural. When they're speaking of the functions of the office, it's episcopos, the bishop. And that denotes the function of the office. Have I been clear to you on that? Question?
No. Quite clear.
No? I hope so. Now, the word priest is a linguistic contraction of the word presbyter.
Elder.
Elder, yeah, uh-huh. Now, the episcopal form of government, not the papal, but the episcopal form developed by the year 250. You can see it grow in three stages. I'm going to do this very briefly and quickly. The first stage is seen by Ignatius in Antioch, in Syria. The second stage is exemplified by Irenaeus in Gaul. I mentioned him, I think, two times ago as one of the more evangelical of the early fathers. Did I not mention I-R-N-A-E? I think I did. But the third stage is seen in Cyprian in North Africa. Bishop Cyprian, Saint Cyprian. In these three men, the three stages are witnessed or seen. In the writings of Ignatius, the Bishop of Antioch, as I pointed out before, or allegedly the first Bishop of Antioch, the episcopate is first distinguished from the presbyter. In other words, he, as bishop, he is conscious of a difference between himself and the presbyters in that particular diocese. But note this, and this is very important. In Ignatius, the bishop is a congregational office, not an officer of diocese. He is a leading presbyter within a particular congregation. He's not a bishop of diocese yet. He's certainly not Pope of Rome. Let me give you a proof of what I'm saying. This is from the Anti-Nicene Fathers, from the letters of Ignatius. Quote, wherever the bishop is found, there let the people be. As where Christ is, there is the Catholic Church. Without the bishop, it is not lawful to either baptize or to celebrate a love feast, the Lord's Supper. This is the first time in the word Catholic is used to the church, but he's talking here of a local congregation. See, it's in the local congregation where the Lord's Supper is celebrated. It's in the local congregation where the baptism takes place. So he's very definitely speaking of a local congregation, and he regards himself there as the first among equals, as the episkopos of episkopoi among the presbyters. It's not the diocesan office. It is distinctly a congregational office in Ignatius. All right, now let's look at Irenaeus. Irenaeus says about the year 180 that the bishop became the office of a diocese, or the office of a diocese. And he also made another, and he said, in holding this office, the bishop is the continuation of the apostolic office. No, not from Peter, but apostolic. What church do they hold basically this position? Only from Peter. But from the apostles as a whole, it's what? It's the Anglican Church in Great Britain. It's the Episcopal Church in this country. See, the Roman Church narrowed it down not to the apostles as a group, but to Peter as the first pope. Now, why did Irenaeus do this? Was it due to his desire to create a hierarchy? No. Irenaeus placed a great value on the role of the bishopric in standing against heresy. In other words, he recognized that the church must have a standard to protect it against heresy. And he did it. So he exalted the bishop as the continuation of the apostolic line, because they would represent the continuation of apostolic authority in doctrinal matters, and would say, this is heresy and this is orthodox. This is what they want.
In fact, what they were doing is to give a little more authority to the bishop for him to decide what is heresy, what
right.
is good. What
exactly
is
right. Exactly correct. Now, the third development takes place with Cyprian. He wrote a book called the Unitate Ecclesiae. Translating from the Irish, it means on the unity of the church. So, this old Catholic doctrine, Ignatius, Irenaeus, and Polycarponus reaches its maturity about the year 250 in the writings of Saint Cyprian, who was in North Africa, Carthage. He regarded the episcopacy as an unbroken succession from Christ and the apostles, not from Peter, but from the apostolic group as a whole, and they derived their authority from Christ. He took it quite a step behind Irenaeus, in that Christ is the original source of this apostolic authority. And it comes to all the apostles. Now, why does it come to him? The apostles for him are the pillars of unity within the church. After all, he wrote a book, De Unitate Ecclesia, on the unity of the church. Now, the Roman church claims him, and there's some reason for it, but he also threw a monkey wrench in their wheels. He also gave a very high place to the presbyter and said that the bishops must always seek the advice of the presbyters on all important and weighty matters, doctrinal and otherwise. Now, the full idea of the bishop has not yet developed. As a matter of fact, in 398 AD, the Council of Carthage declared this. Now, I want you to pay attention. Quote, the pronouncement of a bishop without the concurrence of the clergy is null and void. Point two, in all ordinations, all presbyters must join the bishops in laying on of hands. In other words, for the ordination of clergy, the presbyters and the bishops lay on hands together. In other words, if you were to be ordained simply by two or three bishops laying on your hands, it's null and void. Now, the Council of Carthage was presided over by whom? Augustine. So when the Roman Church quotes Augustine in support of the papacy, they've overlooked some very important facts which are easily accessible. Because Dr. Heffler, one of their own great historians, turned out a tremendous work called The History of the Council, in which he brings to the forefront all these truths I've given. In fact, I have Heffler at home. So what's available to me is available to the Roman papacy.